Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to introduce Larry Tai. He was an award-winning journalist for the Boston Globe, and he's the author of several books, the latest of which is Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be with you.
So the life of the great pitcher Satchel Paige is a portrait both of the man and of this crazy country, racist country that we live in, and the changes that we went through in that respect in the 20th century. Satchel Paige was born in Mobile, Alabama, a little over 100 years ago. What was Mobile, Alabama like in those days for a typical black family?
Well, it was, in the years just before he was born, it was one of the spots of racial tolerance in the Deep South in America. It was a shining example of that brief period that we call Reconstruction, where racial reconciliation actually looked like it was possible in this country. But the very year that Satchel was born, that tolerance started eroding away. There were lynchings in Mobile. There was a whole series of laws that we now refer to as the Jim Crow laws, specifying what blacks could and could not do. And what they couldn't do is they couldn't go into most public parks, public libraries. They had their own separate and decidedly unequal schools, public transportation. Even things like public bathrooms and water fountains were segregated with signs marking them either as okay for whites or okay for what would then refer to as coloreds or black people.
So he was born into this huge family and a poor family where everybody was expected to chip in. And baseball came really naturally to him because of his just unbelievable arm. He could kill, you describe how he could kill birds in the sky with stones when he was just a kid. And even hunters with shotguns were amazed he could get things that they couldn't get.
He was indeed. And he actually learned when he went to reform school, that's where he first really had a sense of just how well he could pitch a baseball, how hard he could throw, and how accurately, and it was what rescued him. Had it not been for baseball, Satchel was convinced that he would have ended up like his brother Wilson, digging graves for a living and dying a young death.
It's amazing to hear a story about how reform school actually helped somebody. You hear sort of horrible stories today about people going to these schools for adolescents and they come out practically hardened criminals. This was a place where he actually got more food and care and in some ways, not exactly parenting, but adult attention than he did at home.
He did, which was partly a reflection of what you were talking about earlier, the fact that he grew up poor in a family with 11 brothers and sisters and extraordinary competition for what limited parental attention there was. And his mother was a washerwoman. She took in laundry from wealthy white people. His father liked to call himself a landscaper, but in fact he was an occasionally employed gardener. And when Satchel finally got to reform school, this was a place whose very name suggested that it was not going to be an easy life. It was called the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers. It was very much a part of the Jim Crow world back then. But the good news for Satchel and everybody else at that school is that it had been started by the great black leader named Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. Washington's whole self-help philosophy was played out in that school. He believed that everybody who came through their doors, like black society generally, should figure out what they did well and should do it so well, better than anybody, that no whites could limit their opportunities. And Satchel figured out in reform school that he could throw a baseball better than anybody. And when, at the end of 5 long years, he finally got out of reform school, he said, "I've traded 5 years of freedom to learn how to pitch."
Whereas at home, he was throwing bricks at gangs of white kids who were trying to hurt him or his friends or whatever. When he came of age, he got out of reform school. He was almost 18 years old. His very first job was playing baseball.
It was indeed. He went down to a ballpark where his brother Wilson had been playing baseball, and he convinced them the way he always did. He always seemed to have a skeptical audience who were convinced that he couldn't do the things that he boasted about being able to do. He went out there, had the manager stand in against him and take some pitches, and as he blew one baseball after another by them, they signed him up to pitch, and it was just a semi-pro team, but it was his first real job. He made a living by actually going out to the white ball field across town and doing everything from mowing the lawn to picking up broken bats and worn-out balls. But he was pitching for a black team, working for a white team, and doing everything he could to eke out a living by playing baseball.
Now, this was Jim Crow America. Just as an aside, can you tell us where the term Jim Crow came from and what it meant?
Yes, Jim Crow was from an old vaudeville act, and it was an obsequious black man named Jim Crow in this play took on a wider meaning, the same way Uncle Tom did, sort of suggesting a whole era where blacks were seen as playing a role of second-class citizens. And it came to connote this whole level of laws that were passed across the Deep South and into even to the border South states that were specifying by law what had existed for years by tradition, where things were separated into black and white universes. And we had talked about schools and buses and other institutions that were segregated. The one that was the most dramatic, the all-American pastime of baseball, also after years of blacks and whites after the Civil War playing on the same field and even on the same team. In the early 1900s, that became segregated too. The major leagues would not let in any blacks, and so African Americans, who were very talented ball players, formed their own separate and decidedly unequal league called the Negro League, where these all-black teams and generally black owners played in rundown ball fields but played a great level of baseball.
He was such a great pitcher, even among some very good players, and he often heard the phrase, "If only you were white."
He did indeed. It was basically them saying to him, "If only you were white, we'd have an opportunity for you. If only you were white, you could play on our team. If only you were white, you could make more money." He was hearing that repeatedly through his years playing in the Negro Leagues, and it was like this torment. And actually, at one point, the owner of an all-white team in Chattanooga, where he was playing on the all-black team, the owner of the all-white team said to him, "We're so excited about the notion of your being able to pitch for us that what we'd like to do is paint your face white and have you go out on the diamond for us and play against a team called the Crackers from Atlanta," which were Chattanooga's big rival. And Satchel said, "You know, I thought about it, doing it seriously. I'd have made enough money. But when they saw me out on the mound, whether I was painted white or green or orange, everybody would know once I started pitching the ball that only Satchel could pitch that way."
Well, that brings us to a wonderful part of this book. I mean, I'd never seen, I don't know, there must be films of him, but I've never actually seen it. But you described so beautifully the way he pitched, which was unique and not only really effective, I mean, he pitched very, very fast, but also it was really quite entertaining. What was it like?
What it was is that he would kick his leg so high up into the air that it looked like it blacked out the sky, and he would throw his right arm so far forward before he released the ball that by the time he let it go, it looked like the ball was in the batter's face. He was, when he came to the mound, when he was walking in from the bullpen, he'd walk at an incredibly slow pace, basically eating up every applause line, every cheer for him. As he said, "I know they can't start the game till I get there, and I'm going to darn well take my time getting there." He was the ultimate showman who knew when he was out there in the mound that every motion was studied by the fans. And so he was going to, while it all amounted to the same thing, in the early days all he could really throw was hard and harder. He had a fastball, and that was about it. He had so many different motions that he got batters confused. He sometimes got his own catcher confused. He could throw underhand, sidearm, and overhand. He could throw with a double windmill windup, a triple windmill windup, or no windup at all. But it was all part of his entertainment. He really knew how to throw a baseball. He used the kinetics and physics to throw it with an ultimate catapult-like effect, and he did it brilliantly, and fans loved it, and batters swung and missed.
And he also psyched people out with his words as well.
He did indeed. He would show up early at the ball field, and he would set up a matchbook on home plate, and he would proceed to walk the 60 feet, 6 inches, back to the pitcher's mound, and he would throw 10 out of 10 pitches directly over that matchbook. And what he was doing was, for fans who happened to show up early, he was giving them a little bit of a show, and for any opponent who showed up early, he was basically saying, you better watch out, because this is what I can do with a baseball. And it was a total psych out. It did just what he wanted to do, which was it got batters thinking about everything other than the pitch that was about to arrive there. And it was all a way, through his words, through his showmanship, it was a way of saying something special is about to happen and watch out.
Now, entertaining the viewers, the fans, was something that a lot of black baseball players did. And there was this fine line, as you describe it, between entertaining and maintaining your dignity and not becoming an Uncle Tom.
And he never went across that line. He understood that in the days of the Negro Leagues, where drawing a big audience was a big deal and getting people to spend what little money they had to watch a baseball game was not an easy thing to ask them, he understood that he had to entertain before the game and by putting on a show as well as what he was doing as a pitcher. And yet he never crossed the line the same way the Pullman Porters never crossed the line between things that were entertaining and things that would in any way demean them as men. They understood that they had to go to a certain point, but going over that line put them in the category of an Uncle Tom, and the last thing in the world they would ever let themselves become was an Uncle Tom or a Step and Fetch It.
We're talking to Larry Tye, author of the book Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. The hypocrisy of racism in the U.S. comes out everywhere, and there's all sorts of examples that you give, like restaurant owners who are going to the black baseball games but not letting the players eat at their restaurant. And this type of thing, which was rampant, was really damaging to the players, both psychologically and even just to the extent that of not even being able to get served water or food.
It was. What Satchel did, he understood that there was a Jim Crow America that he had to be out there dealing with, and he understood that something as basic as getting his players to be able to buy a meal and sleep in a rooming house or a hotel in the towns that he was playing in was not an easy thing in those days. And yet as soon as he had enough clout and as soon as people knew who he was and wanted him to come to their town enough, he said, I won't come there unless you give me and my ball players a place to basically be human beings. We want somewhere to eat, we want somewhere to sleep, and we want this as part of the deal or we just won't show up. And it was in those days, it sounds so simple today, but in those days it was considered seditious. Seditious enough that the FBI opened up a file on him because it was worried that he was a racial radical.
I mean, that's crazy. Did you get to see the contents of his FBI file?
I did, and what they did was, it was basically a bunch of news clippings. It was the fact that at one point the Daily Worker, the organ of the Communist Party, had started a campaign to stop Jim Crow in baseball, and it was out there trying to interview as many ballplayers as it could from the white and black baseball world to say Jim Crow is a bad idea and we should integrate baseball. And one of the few with the courage to talk to them was Satchel Paige. So that showed up in his FBI file. If he was going into a town and agreed that he'd come there and play against their white team and there was an integrated ball field, that showed up in his FBI file. It was stuff today that we would think must have made it in there as by accident or as a joke, because today it seems so extraordinarily tepid. And it seems particularly ironic that in a later generation, a lot of people wondered whether Satchel had done enough to stand up for his race. But the FBI knew all along that this was one of the few guys who was willing to do that in a very profound way.
I suppose the equivalent today is people who are like Quakers and Unitarians who have FBI files for doing peace work.
Exactly. It is like that. It's like what Martin Luther King or Gandhi did, people who are doing basic sort of civil disobedience. And Satchel was doing it in an extraordinary way. It was like civil disobedience with a sense of humor, because he not only took on things directly by saying, you know, you got to throw out Jim Crow when I come to town, but he so delighted generations of white fans who turned out to watch him that they forgot whether he was black or white. They just understood that this was a guy who was an extraordinary baseball talent and an extraordinarily fun guy to be out there watching. I mean, can you imagine getting an entire sideshow when you go to a ball game that you're watching a guy perform these tricks of throwing a baseball over a matchbook or over a stick of gum? He would call in his outfielders when he was playing against a team where he wanted to make a point. He would call in and have his outfielders sit down in the infield, basically daring the batter that any time they'd hit the ball out of the infield, it would be an automatic home run, and then he'd proceed to throw three strikes and get them out without hitting the ball at all. He was so good that he could do extraordinary things that other people would say were shows or boasts or nobody could really back up, and he went out there and said he was going to do it, and then he did it.
It's funny, when you talk about the civil rights and the really standing up to Jim Crow part of his character, that was very much there. And at the same time, he wasn't really a martyr type. I mean, he was really into money and women and getting his own pleasure and needs met.
It was indeed. He was having a blast when he was doing this. He was earning a living, and he was doing the thing that he most enjoyed and did better than anybody. He was pitching a baseball. So that was one of the things that was extraordinary about him, is while you could look at his story and say it's really a story of tragedy and America at its worst, this was a guy who was out there having so much fun that it's difficult to look at it as anything but a story of triumph.
It does make one think about racism and its legacies that we still have with us today. In many ways, it seems like it's just a really old, ingrained bad habit.
It's a terrible habit, but it also shows us a story of somebody facing a system that seemed like it was unbeatable and aimed at beating him and everybody who was African American and talented down, and yet he overcame it. So it sort of puts into context, it gives us a sense of how it was possible that we could have a black Supreme Court justice, that we could have a black president in America, that it didn't happen by accident, that racism has always been there, and yet there were people upon whose shoulders, whether it's Thurgood Marshall or Barack Obama, that they stood upon the shoulders of guys like Satchel Paige. We have to remember that baseball integrated in America a decade before the schools or the buses or most institutions in this country integrated. And the idea of integrating this all-American pastime set an incredibly important role model for what we could do in the rest of society, and Satchel Paige was one of the key architects of making all that possible.
Jackie Robinson was the first black player in U.S. Major League Baseball. Why was it Jackie Robinson and not Satchel Paige?
That's a good question, and that's a question that Satchel Paige wanted to know. The fact is that the guy who signed Jackie Robinson, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers named Branch Rickey, was out there looking for certain things. He was out there looking for a young guy, and Satchel Paige, when Jackie was signed, was 39 years old and wasn't having the greatest year of his life. He was out there looking for a guy who was willing to go and spend 2 years in the minor leagues, and Jackie Robinson spent 2 years with the Montreal team before he was called up to Brooklyn, and Satchel Paige wasn't about to go spend 2 years in the minor leagues. But most importantly, Branch Rickey was out there looking for a guy who he could control, who was going to say the things and do the things that he told him to do in playing this role as a pioneer. And Satchel Paige never did or said what anybody told him to do. He was much too independent-minded. And so Jackie decided to go with a rookie second baseman from the Kansas City Monarchs named Jackie Robinson rather than with a star pitcher from the Kansas City Monarchs named Satchel Paige.
Now, Satchel Paige was was a great star. Everybody knew him. But for you as a biographer, it was tricky to get solid information, especially on his early playing, because newspapers, which were mostly white, and the black newspapers had a hard time surviving, the white newspapers ignored black baseball leagues and barely wrote about them. Were there some exceptions to this? How did you get your information?
Well, there were a couple ways I got information. One was I dug up what information I could get in all black newspapers, and even though they didn't have the resources to be out there covering every game, they covered a lot of the games that Satchel played in. Then I dug up small-town newspapers from the towns where Satchel barnstormed across America, where he took his all-black team and went into towns and played against anybody from the local farmers and firemen to a semi-pro team to anybody who could raise the money and bring Satchel and his all-black team to town. And a lot of those newspapers, this was big news. Lastly, and most importantly, what I did was I interviewed more than 200 aging Negro Leaguers and Major Leaguers who had played against him or played on his team. And those were people who had extraordinary firsthand stories about what Satchel had done. And when I started hearing the same stories two and three times, I knew that these weren't just legends, that they were eyewitnesses, that they swore independently that they had seen the same things, and that things like calling in his outfielders was in fact something that Satchel did time and again.
What were some of your other favorite stories that they told you?
Well, they actually said that it wasn't just his outfielders that he called in. At times he had his infielders sit down too, so that it was just Satchel and the catcher out there, that any hit anywhere would just go forever and the guy would make it home. And Satchel would do that and he'd strike out the team, and he would do it against junk teams that he was playing on the road, but he'd do it also against top-notch major league opponents. And this was a guy who just was extraordinary in terms of his ability to deliver. He would go out there and set up behind home plate a 2x4 board with nails basically hanging from the edge off of that board. And he'd go back to the pitcher's mound, and he would hit the nails with a baseball and drive the nails into the board, which showed not only how hard he could throw the ball, but how accurately. His catchers said that Satchel threw so hard that they had to cushion their gloves with a beefsteak, put a beefsteak in between their hand and their glove so that their hand wouldn't be stinging after the game. And his teammates had such confidence in his accuracy that they would stand there with a lit cigarette in their mouth and let him, with a hard ball traveling at 90 miles an hour, knock the lit cigarette out of their mouths. And you can imagine the kind of confidence you have to have in a pitcher to let him throw a hard ball at your face at 90 miles an hour and know that he wasn't going to hit you, that he was going to hit that cigarette. There was just one story after another like that, that things that seemed too extraordinary to believe, but they were believable when it came to Leroy Satchel Paige.
Meanwhile, there were stories that Satchel told himself. He has an autobiography, and there are many times where he spoke about his life where the same story is told in 5 or 10 different ways and gets more embellished each time.
That's true, and he actually had 2 autobiographies, and in each of them, the stories showed up, and they showed up a bit differently. And the classic is the how old he was. And I thought it's a simple question of getting some government records. And whatever age he says he is, I can find it out by getting his official documents. So I got his Social Security record, I got his passport file, and I got his draft record. And each of them had a different birthday listed. And all three of them had 2 things in common. One was that they were all lies, and that the other was that they were all dates supplied by Satchel. The truth was sitting there in the Mobile County Health Department in his birth certificate, which showed he was born on July 7th, 1906. So it raises the question, why lie about something as basic as your age, especially when there's a document there, your birth certificate, showing when you were born? And I think he lied about it partly because while the great white baseball players, the Babe Ruths, the Joe DiMaggio's, the Mickey Mantles, had reporters out there following everything they did and fanning their legend for them, Satchel had to go out and be his own spin guy. He had to go out there and fan his own legend. And so when it was cool to be young, he made himself as young as Peter Pan. And when being old was the thing that made him stand out, He was as old as Methuselah. He understood that reporters would write down whatever he said, and he gave them a story that he knew they would print each time and changed it slightly.
And when he actually started playing for the major leagues, he was over 40 years old, although it's not clear that people really knew that at the time.
Well, he was actually, the day he signed his contract in the major leagues with the Cleveland Indians, it was his 42nd birthday, and Bill Veeck, the owner of the Indians who brought Satchel in that season, this was in 1948 in the summer, Bill Veeck had taken a trip to Mobile to check out Satchel's birth certificate and knew exactly how old he was, and yet Veeck was like Satchel. He loved a good story, and he knew reporters, the older he made him, the more likely reporters would write up the thing, and Veeck and Satchel would get attention, and so Veeck made him out to be ancient. And the 42 seems old enough to me to be an extraordinary story for a guy signing his rookie contract, but they decided to fan it a bit.
We're talking to Larry Tye, author of the book Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Satchel Paige went to Latin America, and there were a number of reasons why he did that.
Sure. He went to Puerto Rico and Cuba. He went to the Dominican Republic and Venezuela. And he went there for a few reasons. One was that that was a place, after baseball was shut down in the winter in America, in Latin America, Satchel could make more money, and he played year-round. And he went there, and he pitched not just on the same field with white ball players, but often on the same team. A generation before we integrated our baseball diamonds in America, in Latin America, blacks and whites were playing together in the winter, major leaguers and Negro leaguers, and it was extraordinary. It showed that the sky wouldn't fall and that you could have a great baseball game having blacks and whites play together, and they did it brilliantly for 30 years all across Latin America every winter.
Well, of course, the Caribbean is a place where black and white and brown, although, of course, there's a terrible legacy of slavery there, has been integrated and, indeed, intermarried and interbreeding for a long time. And there's a wonderful quote in the book where I don't know if it was Satchel Paige or another player says this is a place where you can just be a man instead of fighting all the time.
Yes, that wasn't Satchel, but it was a guy who was a good buddy of his who, like Satchel, had experienced the notion that why be out there fighting for rights that they're never going to give us in America when we can just go south of the border to Latin America, and that was a guy who was talking about playing in Mexico, but it was true all across Latin America, and it was an extraordinary opportunity for these guys to experience not just a way to make money and to test their skills against the best of white baseball, but to experience a kind of freedom that they never saw in this country.
You and I spoke several years ago about your book about Pullman porters, and it's interesting that, and you write this in this book, that next to Pullman porters, black baseball players had the greatest ability to travel.
They had a wonderful ability to travel across America. They made more money than just about anybody in black America in those days. The Pullman porters and the baseball players, when they came home, were also stars. I mean, what better thing to do? Every white kid in America was dreaming about being Babe Ruth or Joe DiMaggio, and every African-American kid was dreaming about being Satchel Paige, and that was an extraordinary dream.
What was his relationship like with young people? Did he mentor young baseball players?
He did. He, over the years, had more young ball players, black ball players when he was in the Negro Leagues and white and black ball players when he was in the major leagues, who he took under his wing. And these are people who we now know as wonderfully familiar names. And I'm talking about guys like Hank Aaron, the wonderful home run champion who grew up in Mobile where Satchel had grown up, whose dad was a buddy of Satchel's, and who came up on the Atlanta Braves when Satchel was there as a pitching coach. And Satchel took these players under their wing. He wanted them to understand what it had been like growing up in the segregated Jim Crow world, but he also wanted them to understand all the extraordinary opportunity they had. And he wasn't a guy who one of his most famous sayings, and he had lots of things that he was famous for, but the one that got him into Bartlett's Book of Quotations expressed his attitude about life that he conveyed to these young ball players, and the expression was, "Don't look back. Somebody might be gaining on you." And in Satchel Paige's case, if he had looked back, he would have seen stories of oppression, and instead he was looking ahead to stories of opportunity.
Satchel Paige was what we now might call a free agent, but that, I don't know, did that term even exist at the time?
He was a free agent in the 1920s and 30s, and it wasn't until the 1970s that that term came into our lexicon with major league ball players. And what that meant was that he would sign a contract and as quick as not break it if somebody else offered him more money. He would barter his services and rent himself out, and he was good enough that even owners that he had broken a contract with, when they could get him back, took him back instantly. He was just good enough to be able to go out there and exercise an independence that ballplayers didn't have. Generally, ballplayers, for most of the history of the major leagues and Negro leagues, they were under the contract in a feudal kind of system to the owners who had bought their services and had first signed them, and it was extraordinary the way Satchel tested these owners' patience and the legal limits, and he generally won because he was that good. And when he won, all of Negro Leagues won, because when his salary got kicked up, everybody under him generally got more money as well.
So was he able to earn pretty good money?
Well, he was earning in the late 1930s $40,000 a year. And to put that into a little context, the average New York Yankee then was earning a quarter of that. Ted Williams, the great batting champ for the Boston Red Sox, was earning half as much as Satchel, and he was making as much as the great Joe DiMaggio was making, and as much as Babe Ruth, and it was just extraordinary. On the other hand, whereas all the great white major leaguers only pitched from April, if they were lucky, into October, if they made the playoffs, and they would pitch, if they were the average pitcher in the major leagues, every fifth game, Satchel Paige was out there pitching three or four innings just about every night, and he was pitching from April to April. He pitched in the Negro Leagues. He barnstormed across the country. In the winter, he went to California and pitched in the Winter League there. Then when it stopped there, he would go south to Latin America, and he was working harder than anybody, but he was making more money than anybody.
It's amazing that his arm didn't give out. I mean, it did once, and then it just healed itself somehow. But basically, this arm, this incredible 100-mile-an-hour pitching arm, lasted for decades.
It lasted for nearly 50 years, and it lasted, there was only one time for a period of less than a year where he had a serious injury. What Satchel would say is that today we're babying our pitchers. We only pitch them every fifth game. When they get to 100 or 110 pitches, we yank them out of the game, that we are so careful with them that their arm doesn't develop the strength and the conditioning that his did. And his was easily the best conditioned arm on the planet, and for him it worked. He could pitch all the time, and he could pitch what seemed like forever.
Baseball teams, the owners of baseball teams, had an economic self-interest in signing black players, and then that ended up really challenging racism when it came time to integrate baseball.
It did indeed, and yet the bad news about signing black players was that it killed the Negro Leagues. So the white owners won't let blacks in, and this parallel universe of the Negro Leagues forms up. And then when they finally start signing players like Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey didn't pay the owners of the black team that he was under contract to a penny. And so they set up the Negro Leagues, in reality, by keeping blacks out of their leagues, and then they destroyed the Negro Leagues when it suited their economic purpose and when they realized that white fans would come and watch black ball players and they could make money out of the Satchel Paiges and the Jackie Robinsons.
So tell us about Satchel Paige's major league career.
So he signed in the summer of 1948. The Cleveland Indians are involved in the tightest pennant race in the history of baseball. It's the Indians against the Red Sox and the Yankees. And by July of that year, the owner of the Cleveland Indians, Bill Veeck, decides the way he's going to separate himself from his two competitors is by going out and signing this old guy named Satchel Paige. He brings him down to the ballpark one morning and brings his player manager, a guy named Lou Boudreau, down to see Satchel, but he doesn't tell Boudreau who he's going to watch work out. And he's telling Boudreau, this is a guy who I think can win enough games for us to really make a difference in this pennant race. And then he points to the dugout, and Boudreau sees Satchel Paige there. And he thinks, this old man, this has got to be some sort of a joke, not Satchel Paige. So Boudreau stands in at the batter's plate against Satchel. And Boudreau, as I say, was a player manager, and he was competing with Ted Williams that year for the batting crown. And he takes about 30 pitches from Satchel, and none of them are close to a hit. So at the end of the 30 pitches, he says to Veeck, sign him, Will. And the next day, on Satchel's 42nd birthday, Veeck signs Satchel. Well, Satchel, as always, came through for the owner who had faith in him. He pitched to a 6-1 record that year, helping take the Indians to the pennant and to the World Series. He had the second lowest earned run average in all of the major league and all of the American League. And at the end of the year, when the Associated Press sports writers were voting their choice for the Rookie of the Year, a dozen of them voted for 42-year-old Satchel Paige. And Satchel had two reactions. He says, on the one hand, I'm delighted that you chose me. On the other hand, when you called me the Rookie of the Year at 42, I wasn't quite sure what year you were talking about.
Right.
And Satchel went on in the major leagues to pitch another season for Cleveland. He pitched 3 years in the early 1950s for the St. Louis Browns. And then in 1965, he came back for an extraordinary three innings with the Kansas City A's. An owner named Charlie Finley, a real character, realized he was having a tough time filling his ballpark. And so near the end of the season in September, he brought in this ancient Satchel Paige. He set him up in the bullpen in a rocking chair with a nurse in a white uniform rubbing some sort of cream into his arm and a personal water boy standing by. And then he sent him out for the first three innings of the ball game. And he didn't really care what Satchel did. He had already come close to filling the ballpark. And whatever he did would have been good for Veeck because it would have made him money. Satchel wouldn't let anybody else write his last line. So he went out there, he pitched three shutout innings against the Boston Red Sox. The only guy to get a hit off him was a young slugger named Carl Yastrzemski, who after the game went up and gave Satchel a bear hug. And he gave him a bear hug because fully a generation before that, Yastrzemski's dad had hit against Satchel in a semi-pro game on Long Island. Satchel was the only guy in the history of baseball that fathers and sons and even grandsons could pitch against because he lasted that long. That night, Satchel Paige set a record for the oldest player ever in the history of baseball, and it's a record that will never be broken. He was 59 years, 2 months, and 8 days old. He was exactly 33 years older than his catcher that night.
And he was still playing. That was his last game?
It was his last game in the majors, but he went on pitching into his 60s. He had seven young kids at home that he had to support, and he went on pitching into his 60s anywhere he could find a game and anywhere he could find somebody who was willing to pay him. He barnstormed across America. He played in Canada. He was extraordinary going out there and throwing a baseball. The idea of somebody in their 60s being anywhere other than in the baseball stands drinking beer was amazing. And today we think it's a miracle when guys like Roger Clemens or Tim Wakefield come out and pitch in their 40s, and Satchel Paige was doing it 20 years later than that.
Now he, as you said, had this idea that he wasn't, people now are babying the pitchers, and he just conditioned by playing so much. But even in his day, that was extremely unusual.
It was exceedingly unusual, and he could only do it partly because he started out with these extraordinary genes and partly because he gave his arm such practice and conditioning that it could hold up longer than anybody thought was physically possible.
Just to back up a little bit, when he was young, he only had this hardball, as you said. How did he develop and the discipline and the skill to be a first-class pitcher with all different kinds of pitches?
It was practice, practice, practice. He would go out and practice for hours before his teammates showed up at a ball game, throwing a baseball through a hole in a fence, through a knot in a fence that was the size of a grapefruit, or knocking down Coke bottles. He went out there and, with help from some of the older Negro Leaguers, taught himself how to throw a knuckleball, taught himself to throw a curveball that Joe DiMaggio said took such a bend that it gave him optical indigestion. He was extraordinary. He went, and as he learned that his fastball was no longer enough, he went out and taught himself a repertoire of pitches that was comparable to what anybody had in today's fine-tuned world of having fancy trainers go out there and teach you how to throw. Satchel did it himself because that was the only way he could do it.
So what happened after his retirement at the age of 59? Well, you said he kept playing, but in other words...
He kept playing into his 60s, and when he finally was forced to retire, he basically was at home most of the time. He had no other way to make a living, and he got to know his kids in a way that he never had because he was out there throwing a baseball all the time and traveling the country, and his kids delighted in it. I was just with three of his daughters a week ago in Kansas City, where they live, and they thought of this guy as an iconic character. He was their dad. He was incredibly down-to-earth and got them to understand that they were going to have to make it on their own, that just being the daughter or the son of the great Satchel Paige wasn't enough and wasn't going to get him anywhere. He worked hard enough to put his kids through school and make sure they got an education that he hadn't had, and he was an amazing dad and granddad.
This was a wonderful project for you, because I take it you've been a baseball fan all your life.
I've been a baseball fan all my life. I've heard stories of the great Satchel Paige all my life. And the idea of being able to go out and track this stuff down and call baseball work for 2 years was amazing. But it also, I wrote this book in part for young kids, kids who would never sit down and read a book about segregation or Jim Crow, but might do that if it was a book disguised as a biography of a brilliant baseball player. And so this is a story I'm trying to use to tell the story, not just of Satchel Paige, but of that whole era that he embodied of Jim Crow America.
What do you think is Satchel Paige's legacy, like if you have to sum up what he did, both for baseball and for the country?
I put it in the words that an old Negro leaguer used for me, and he was much more eloquent than anything I could say about Satchel. He said that it was Jackie Robinson who opened the doors to the new racial reality in baseball and in American society, but it was Satchel Paige who inserted the key. Jackie Robinson is rightfully thought of as the father of baseball integration, but it was Satchel who was the grandfather, and it was Satchel and all those old Negro leaguers like him upon whose shoulders Jackie Robinson stood in integrating baseball.
It's such a well-written book, and it takes you back to the times and places and feelings and smells. I take it you visited all the places, or many of the places where he played, where he was born and raised, and so on. Tell us a little more about your experience of actually doing the research.
It was wonderful because everywhere I went, in addition to doing what you were saying, visiting the places, trying to absorb the smells and the feels and the sounds, I was talking to these ancient ball players. I went to Florida and interviewed on his 111th birthday an old Negro Leaguer ball player named Silas Simmons. I went to Puerto Rico and I interviewed ball players who were 100 and older, who remembered and told brilliant and vivid stories about Satchel Paige. It was really associating him with real human beings who had been out there and played with or against him that made his stories come alive and gave real meat to this story that I was trying to put together about him, and made it a great joy to tell it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Larry Tai is the author of the book Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend.
It was great to be with you. Thank you.
Here's a clip from the speech Satchel Paige gave upon his induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1971.
We played up in Canada, and if I didn't pitch every day, they didn't want to ball the club. And that's how I started. Once the pitching every day, I pitched in 165 ball games in a row, because if I didn't pitch, they didn't want to, the club in town, let alone there. And so I guess all that got me up to Hilton Cooperstown.
And you can find out more about Satchel Paige at LarryTye.com, LarryTye.com. We're going to go out with a song by Frederick Douglass Kirkpatrick called Leroy Satchel Paige.
Hello, everybody. My name is Satchel Paige. Hello, everybody. My name is Satchel Paige. I started playing baseball during my early years. And I was born in Alabama in a city called Mobile. And I was born in Alabama in a city called Mobile. I knew by the age of 12 that baseball gonna be my field. I learned how to pitch ball by simply throwing rock. Oh, I learned how to pitch ball by simply throwing rocks. Trying to tuck myself from the white folks in the evening around 4 o'clock. I never started a fight, but I was always asked to stop. Oh, I never started a fight, but I was always asked to stop. If I disobeyed them, they just simply call a cop. Hello, everybody, my name is Satchel Paige. Oh, everybody, my name is Satchel Paige. I started playing baseball during my early 80s. I pitched Dizzy Dean, Bob Feller, and all the rest. I pitched Dizzy Dean, Bob Feller, and all the rest. I'm a real bone baseballer, and man, I can stand the test. I made the big leagues at the age of 42. I made the big leagues at the age of 42. If I had been a white man, I'd have made it at 22. Hello, everybody. My name is Satchel Paige. Hello, everybody. My name is Satchel Paige. I started playing baseball during my early age. So remember, everybody, my name is Satchel Paige. Remember, everybody, my name is Satchel Paige. I started playing baseball.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news. And after that, good morning, jazz.